Hello and welcome to the JC podcast, Deconstructing Humans. This podcast is a hard-hitting real talk experience with everyday people like you and me. I ask some of the hard questions about their life, triumphs, tribulations, and lessons they've learned along the way. I want to dive deep into everyday people to find out who they are. I want to be able to peel back the layers as to what path someone has taken in life, what tribulations they've faced, and advice they have to give from these experiences. They're everyday people. People we can easily relate to, who have been through or are currently going through good times or bad times. Hello everyone. The human I'm deconstructing today is a bit of an old world gent. He's an author and all-round advocate for ambitious young men. So I did a bit of background digging on this guest before I interviewed him, and at first there seemed to be quite a few people with his name, all pretty ambitious sounding guys as well. One collection of articles and stories described an athlete turned model turned businessman who started a number of innovative businesses all around the world. He'd launched tech incubator cafes in Dubai and sports supplement companies in Australia and complex healthcare networks throughout Europe and Asia. Then I found articles about another guy with the same name who was a scholar and academic type, a university lecturer to thousands of science students, someone who held 4 college degrees across science and philosophy and had helped reshape teaching science at university. That guy was ultimately recognized with an award for excellence in teaching and a university medal. One page described him as a heart and diabetes researcher, a cardiac microsurgeon with a CV full of research articles he'd written on obesity, the heart, bones, and anabolic steroids, and had a medical textbook chapter in his name. He'd also just been interviewed in another podcast by a big American heart journal that celebrated his research. By the end of it, I found this guy's name featured by the Australian newspaper, the ABC National Radio, and the Today Show, and listed by a large Australian uni as a recent alumnus of the year. And to my surprise, as it turns out, all of these stories belong to the same guy. More surprisingly, he only just turned 30, and he joins me today.
From all the way in Melbourne, Australia. Dan, just like to say thank you very much for being here, mate.
Oh, thanks for having me, James.
It's a pleasure to have you on, mate. And I've known Dan for many years now and would have heard the introduction that I've done for this episode. But Dan, would you like to go into a bit about sort of your upbringing and where you are currently and something of that nature?
Sure. It's not that long a story, really. I've only just hit 30, so where have I come from? Well, we actually had fairly, from what I can glean, James, we had fairly similar upbringing, very similar part of the world.
Yes.
I was born in Sydney, and they went through Catholic upbringing, a little primary school on the Gold Coast in Queensland, in Australia. And from there, found a way into the private high school, an old boys' school, TSS, the same as yours, the Southport School, and then jumped straight into study after that. So, you know, I did finish 4 consecutive degrees after high school. So I've practically been in education since I was 5. So about 25 years of straight formal education, but
yeah,
11
wow.
years of degrees. It was a bit of an up and down journey through university, and it was, you know, an invaluable experience, and I loved every part of it. There's a ton of lessons, sort of off-label.
Yes, of course.
Lessons, things that I learned outside of the classroom that were, you know, invaluable. Things I think you'd learn anyway, potentially through different choices in life.
Of course.
It's a fairly humble little story, but we get to the end of it, and now card-carrying PhD and working in cardiac physiology and research microsurgery, and that's sort of my day job these days as a scientist and researcher.
Absolutely. And what led you down that path of study, Dan? What interests you about the cardiac physiology?
It's to be very honest, it was not none of it was really premeditated from any stage. It sort of all just fell together. So, and originally, to be completely honest with your listeners, I left when I left high school and started uni. I actually started in dentistry. I didn't know which direction I'd be going. I had a couple of friends who were going into dentistry, and didn't really have a ton of people to ask. I was the first in my family to go to uni. As far as I knew at that stage, we had a sort of very small family, just myself, my mother, and my sister, both great ladies. And then I sort of changed after a year, after studying a bit of human anatomy and falling in love with human physiology, the way that all that anatomy moves around and interacts. I moved into biomedical science.
Yes.
And then polished off that degree. But it was changing degrees at that stage was a little bit more difficult than it is today. There was a bit of, there were some penalties in changing and, set yourself back quite a bit to start all over again. And it was a bit of a difficult time to be honest. And it's actually a bit of a long story, but skipping right ahead, I got to the end of that degree and I hadn't, some of those penalties were still hanging around from that change. And it was a bit difficult to do much with that degree, as much as I loved all of the different parts of it.
Sure.
And the interestingly, what kind of happened at the end of that was I had this talk. How they force you to get all these work on these group projects and then give all these presentations in your undergrad, and they can be quite terrifying if you're not one of those people who just loves to talk.
Yeah,
I definitely haven't been, and I'm still working on it, as you can no doubt tell. But
so am I, mate. Don't worry.
There was this real fear, man, a phobia when I finished that course, that last presentation that I gave in third year. I had one of those real hot under the collar. You walk up to the front of the classroom and you can feel how red your face is, and
yes,
just stressed, and
absolutely
can't get a word out. You don't remember any of it, and you sit down, and
yes,
when that finished, it really affected me, and it felt, for whatever reason, as if that was somehow going to hold me back in life, and it's going to be a real problem. So that was one of the things that I wanted to address, and that's sort of my approach to things. If I really hate something, then I just feel like I need to get better at it.
You got
to
keep doing it. That's
work
right.
Work out an appreciation for it. And so the next year, I actually went up to one of the lecturers at the university there and asked if I could try my hand at teaching, and begged and pleaded, and they were lovely enough to give me that opportunity. And then as that started, it was just as stressful the first few, and then it started to make a little bit more sense that everybody was fairly similar. And it was actually quite confronting to meet all of these students who were all in first year. I was teaching a first year course, just as one of those like a demonstrator in a practical lab, which you have in science all the time. And it was interesting to hear all these stories of people who were, fantastic students and not so great students, people with the same sort of backgrounds. And it was, for some reason, I hadn't really experienced that throughout my studies. I hadn't really met as many people as I met in probably, the first week of teaching.
Yes.
Anyway, that sort of helped move things along pretty quickly. I actually really fell in love with teaching.
That's great.
Within a year, I was lecturing. I was given a group of lectures to give on endocrinology, which are all hormones.
Yes.
And that was my area of research. I started a master's degree in medical research and looking at the heart, but more so the hormones that affect the heart. So I had this sort of just amazing opportunity to start lecturing, and there was such a large cohort. There's about 500, 600 students. So it was this, I was pushing myself to the absolute limits when it came to public speaking in that sort of forum in front of a crowd at a university. That was probably the biggest crowd I could have ever imagined speaking to.
Yes.
And it was just the most enjoyable experience. And that sort of grew and grew into different lectures for different courses. And I taught a lot, and I did some research into teaching and developing curriculum, and I worked with some amazing lecturers at Griffith University, and we put together some innovative changes to how we teach science, and it became part of my specialties, really. And the university gave me an award for teaching in 2011, the university medal for teaching, which was
excellent.
A bit of one of those recognition points that, you know, mightn't mean a lot to most people, but considering where I'd come from only a few years beforehand, it meant a lot to me, and it felt like, okay, I've tackled this fear that I had, you know, a handful of years ago. And then, so the teaching is a part of something that I've always loved doing. I taught at that university for about 7 years, 6 or 7 years.
Yes.
While I was studying my master's and then my PhD and another degree on top of those somewhere in the middle, and in research management. And then that was the end of my sort of study period, and then I moved on and started full-time work at the ripe old age of 30. The first time I had a full-time job was at 30 when I finished all my study.
Wow, that's amazing, mate. I think we're on two different ends of the spectrum here, because I didn't do uni at all. Like, I did a certain amount of study to get into the career that I'm into, well, that I was in at the current time, but that's an amazing amount of commitment to your studies. What kept you going throughout all those many years? And it's not like what you're studying is amazing and quite complex, so the workload would be, I could only imagine, quite heavy. How did you go about keeping yourself motivated, keeping yourself getting through all the projects and presentations and everything that you had to do?
That's a good question, man. I mean, I know it could probably seem like we took two very different paths, but I think I'd assume that our lessons that we learned throughout that same sort of, say, the 10-year period that I was at uni, and you were taking making very clever decisions to get straight into the workforce as quickly as you could.
Trust me, pretty much.
I don't use the word regret much, but I do. I did envy those, you know, getting on with life a lot sooner than I did.
Mm.
There's a bit of workload in the PhD, certainly.
I
probably
bet.
the busiest year of my life was the master's degree, but it was also the most enjoyable. I try to unpack quite often how I got to that point. There were a couple of years between my undergrad where I was teaching and, you know, just tackling some of these limiting capacities that I had and trying to develop myself so aggressively that I ended up doing so much in that period.
Mm.
So when I was teaching and studying that master's, I joined a company as a scientific advisor for a supplement company.
Yes.
I helped develop some products, and we really tried to take a very alternative approach to the game of health supplements. And it is it's very loosely a game. Games generally have rules, but the supplement industry doesn't really. So
yes,
that was terribly confronting. But we tried to do things right, and worked uphill for 4 or 5 years in that company. Ended up taking the reins towards the end of it, and becoming the director and running that myself for a couple of the last years there. But that was a very sort of busy first engagement with any sort of independent projects and work. All at the same time, I started an iPhone app that was back when those things were the ways to innovate, and everybody had an idea for an app, and
of course.
Wasn't that hard to start them. And well before there were Android phones on the market that were kind of squished the iPhones out of the market. But that was an interesting project. And I just picked up all these little projects along the way. And
wow.
Publications, and it was a busy couple of years.
That's amazing, mate. That's an amazing amount of work there. I'm just going off your website here, if you don't mind, just looking at the publications, like 12 articles, one textbook, 146 citations and 6 H indexes. Is that right for research?
The H index. Yeah, it's a funny thing. It's sort of a way of interpreting how cited each of your papers are. So an H index of 6 just means that 6 papers have been cited at least 6 times.
Ah, got you.
So if I had 7 papers with 6 publications each, or sorry, 6 citations each, then you'd still have an H index of 6.
Got you, mate.
Yeah, sort of. It's a way of squaring. But so the research side of things has been going fairly well. I had about 10 or 11 publications by the time I finished my PhD, which was fairly unusual compared to those around me, at least. It was quite a good, I had a pretty good run through a lot of collaborations and different projects through my study. So that was,
sure.
I was fairly lucky. You know, it was always fun working with different groups. So we all sort of worked on different projects together. And my PhD was a bit of an ambitious project in itself. It did take me into different directions. I started off as a, very interested in heart research after my master's, and generally, for those unfamiliar, it's when you take on a master's degree or an honors degree, something at that level, you're generally given a project and you work on that as your supervisor tells you to. And then when you get to your PhD, if you're lucky, and it's not always the case, if you're lucky, you get to have a bit more control over what that project's going to be.
Okay.
And sometimes you're just handed, a similar project or an extension of your master's, or you're needed somewhere in an existing portfolio of projects, and you don't have as much control. But regardless, you become very passionate whatever you're doing. But when I started my PhD, my brilliant supervisor, he gave me the free rein to do whatever I wanted. So I was really interested in sex hormone science, to put it broadly, but sort of the effects of having low and high testosterone as males, and how that affects the heart and all the different body systems, and different ways of raising those testosterone levels, and sort of alternative ways of having the same effects through different types of drugs. So we looked at quite a lot in that period, and we looked at the heart and the prostate and the skin, all these different things that sort of come up when you talk to people about their experiences with either testosterone replacement therapy or androgen deprivation therapy, which is one of those treatments that they quite typically give to men who have prostate cancer. They basically wash out or knock down all of the testosterone they're producing because it's causing problems in the prostate. And when you do that so aggressively, it causes some real issues for those guys. And it's such a big problem, prostate cancer for men. And,
absolutely.
I know you've had some involvement in raising funds and
yes,
and working prostate.
Yes, absolutely, Dan. Yeah, because it's affected my family. Like, my grandfather had it, and amongst of other health issues at the time, he was this tough country bloke, and I can be honest in saying he wasn't the best kind of guy to go see the doctor. And as far as I'm aware, prostate cancer is still the number one most diagnosed cancer in Australia. Dan, would you confirm that at all?
In Australia, I haven't looked at Australian statistics, but generally, playing off the American ones, but it's probably I wouldn't be surprised at all if it is still.
It is still, yeah, because that's what I saw in 2016, I believe, when I first started the Movember fundraiser that we do every year. And how sort of significant it was. Even when I was in Canada, I was speaking to a few people in the medical research field there. It's the same story there. So it's pretty serious thing that us blokes need to be more aware of, I would say. So,
Definitely the most frequently diagnosed cancer in men.
Yes.
We still get diagnosed with things like breast cancer as well, but prostate cancer is that's the biggest issue. And it's quite a complex disease to sort of understand and then treat. And I've had the privilege of speaking to some pretty amazing oncologists.
Yes.
People who've treated prostate cancer in a multitude of different ways around the world, and went to the International Congress on Steroid Research in Chicago, but 2012, I think it was, and met a few different surgeons and oncologists who just had completely different ways of treating it, all with varying degrees of success, and they're a highly collaborative group. But yeah, it's at those conferences and things that I started to hear the actual patient stories as a basic scientist, as they call us, when you're not working with, you know, directly with patients, when you're working on the absolute rest of the scientific puzzle, and you're trying to work out everything from cells to preclinical research and drug, you know, preclinical drug trials and things. That's all called basic research. But as a basic research, you don't really, you don't hear the one-on-one stories from clinicians until you go to these conferences and hear the real impacts of what you're doing and what you could be doing to help these people. And that was a real eye-opening experience back then at the beginning of my degree. But it's, yeah, I'm sorry to hear that about your grandfather, man. That's
no, that's okay. It's it's a very common
rough journey.
Oh, absolutely. It's definitely heavy. Are there any, I suppose, any advice for that you would know off the top of your head for signs for guys to keep? What sort of age group would we need to start worrying about this sort of thing? Is it in your 40s or 50s, or do we need to keep an eye on it as early as 20s? You never know.
Yeah. Well, the recommendations are from your 40s. You're getting, So having a look inside every year or so, which is probably not that sounds like a pretty good idea to me.
Yes.
Considering, you know, the prevalence in Western populations, at least. What else can we do? Well, it's quite complex. It's very hard to work out whether or not you're going to be a high risk or low risk for prostate cancer. And I mean, there's school of research looking to family hereditariness. So it's worth being having a grandfather with a story such as yours, you might want to just be on top of that as well. And then everyone in your family, I'm sure you're all
certainly we're very aware. Our grandmother, my mother's mother, had breast cancer. Luckily, she survived. She's gone past the mark. I'm not sure how many years it is after once you've had the breast removed that she's clear, which is great. So we are very on top of all of that. And I'm a big ambassador for that with everyone. Like always say, you might be as fit as anything in the world, but you just don't know what lies below. So you always got to be on top of whatever health checks, like always just your health generally if you can.
Yeah, well, that's it. But not as many people are. I mean, everybody's touched by cancer in some way.
Yes.
If you're a family member or not. But
absolutely.
You know, having that experience makes you somebody who will definitely appreciate the value in taking care of your health in a preventative way.
Absolutely.
Not everybody's like that, James.
All right, that's
people
right.
Need a little bit more coaxing, encouragement.
Oh, I know.
You try to help people without having to... without them having to have those experiences themselves.
Yeah.
I don't encourage people, but it's a bit hard to, I mean, even at 30, I still in some ways feel like I've got that feeling of invincibility that I had when I was 20.
Of course.
That you've got to keep reminding yourself that, you know, it doesn't take much.
Oh, absolutely. Even because when my marketing and business development career in charity fundraising started in hospitals, like I was at the PA, Princess Alexandra Hospital in Brisbane, Queensland, and that was a bit of a shock just sort of to see how you realize how precious life is without a doubt, and how, like, I met a gentleman who was my age who was terminally ill with, I believe it was melanoma, I'm pretty sure, and you're just like, wow, like he was my age, and I was talking to him, I never forget it. And yeah, I was just like, from then on, like, you always wear your sunscreen, always get your health checked, just this is always things that are always in the back of my mind that I always try to but I always try to remind people about, and I'm sure you're the same. So
just keeping people in check, keeping yourself in check. Melanoma is another one of those scary things, especially as a young Australian growing up in this gap.
Yeah, the strong sun.
yeah, we get fairly cooked. I've had something like 16 or 17 biopsies of
really
holes in me. Yeah, throughout the years, I spent a lot of time in the sun when I was growing up.
Me too.
Surf life saving, and as a lifeguard through those undergrad years, and I mean, I think we all get a lot of sun down here. It took 16 or 17. Like, it took. I was still in the sun at the 17th. You know, I was still lifeguarding. So
of course, of course.
It takes a lot to really hit home that, you know, you're not. No one's
invincible.
Indestructible. Yeah.
And even in Australia, like if I walk around, I'm currently in Los Angeles, and if I walk around the sun here, like it feels fine. Like I wouldn't get burnt within like half an hour, 45 minutes. But in Australia, you're out there for 10, 15 minutes on a really sunny day, you're burnt pretty quickly. So it's
Northern Australia, specifically like Queensland and things for sure.
Yes.
Melbourne feels a little bit different down here. I've only been here just over a year, but yeah, it's what, 4 degrees.
Yeah.
Celsius here today, and there's not probably going to be much sun
yeah
for the rest of the day. But yeah, that Queensland living and that
Queensland living,
Australian living.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, Dan, there's so many things you've done, so I'm a bit overwhelmed on where to go to next. But the one thing that could be pretty cool to touch on is your everything that you've done in the media. And I've just looked at articles that you've done for the Gold Coast Bulletin, and I believe you spoke on the Today Show about, I think it was the steroid epidemic, steroid abuse throughout Australia and things like that.
Yeah, well, that was, yeah, I can talk you through how that happened. It was quite a strange series of events. That was, I'd had my first dealings with some sort of media in the early years of my PhD. I think it was about a year in. The local newspaper called me up to ask me what I was looking at. And we had a quick chat about the steroid that I was looking at in researching, because it was originally a cattle drug, so a drug that a lot of Australian farmers and American farmers put into cattle to make sure that when they, you know, when they jump on the truck on the way to become meat,
yep,
you know, to be package, as terrible as it is to imagine, that's it stops them from losing a lot of weight, and weight is meat, and meat is money, and that's sort of how that industry has boomed.
Simple.
So there's a lot, yep, of these steroids in your steak in use all around the world, and the ones that they tend to use now are the ones that are eliminated pretty quickly after that, and that they don't end up in the meat that we eat. So that one of those drugs, I was just very strangely reading about one of those drugs that by itself, when you put it into any steer or cattle, and it's just like a chain of implants, like a little, these little yellow pellets they put behind the ear. I was reading this paper that was so outside of my field. It was in palatability studies and sort of food science and how chewy this steak was, and all this. It's sort of weird to read in scientific literature that, but I'm sure it's a huge, very legitimate industry and all legitimate field. Mm. But it was strange to read that sort of terminology in science for me. And then it was strange that it got chewy, and they were attributing it to having no fat. So this steroid that they were putting into these animals stripped away all the fat and marbling from the meat. And I thought, well, that wasn't good for the steak. But then they had to give the animals other drugs like estradiol, estrogens, like female sex hormones, to balance this marbling out. And I thought, well, that can't be a bad thing in humans if we remove, you know, if we're cutting down the fat depositions in our muscles and around our muscles. And that's literally where that thought process started, very, very humbly and just sort of idiosyncratically. And then we had a closer look at the research into one of these drugs, a selective androgen receptor modulator. They're called SARMs, just in case people are probably more familiar with that term if they've, you know, spent any time in that space or spoken to people in the gym or listened to people talk about steroids before. SARMs are this next generation of steroids. And yes, so we had a close look at this one particular steroid, trenbolone, and it got a lot of attention. So I spoke to the media just back then about how this cattle drug was going to help us try to develop a new treatment for overweight men. And then it got more and more complicated as we moved forward and we looked at different models of obesity and how they all interacted. And it's actually quite a complex system, the way that hormones work and bounce off of each other. What happened towards the end there was I, being sort of like an acknowledged steroid researcher and being someone who back then went to the gym quite a bit, that was the conversation I had a lot. As soon as anyone got a whiff of the fact that I had anything to do with steroid research, man, did I have some very interesting questions and some pretty interesting stories come my way. People I've never met telling me about their experiences with steroid use and steroid abuse and where they'd, you know, what I thought about this and that. And I was obviously very careful even at that stage. You know, that wasn't a a scrap of recommendation I'd give it. Never really, you know, I was so scared of that whole real world use of it when it was all illicit and illegal. I didn't want to talk about any of that with anyone, but it was interesting just to hear these stories at least and have these conversations with these people and learn about their experiences with what I thought was quite a new and novel drug. Had actually been on the black market and steroid use for a few years. So there'd been people who'd actually experienced using it themselves.
Sure.
And that sort of shone some light on things that I needed to look at in my research and raise some funny, interesting questions that had never really been asked because they were limited to the forums of bodybuilding websites and that sort of thing. So it was sort of this reverse education process, sort of being learning all these different things from people I was talking to and that feeding back into different areas of my research that sort of helped us at least guide us towards asking the right questions and so on in the research.
Sure.
But towards the end there, it was actually pretty confronting to find out how many people were on or had taken steroids and people that I'd had known for many years, people I'd come across in the gym, people you'd never think had ever taken steroids. And it got to a point where statistically, there was more steroids became the most commonly sold or exchanged illicit substance on the Gold Coast where I was living.
Wow.
And it was a bigger problem than ice. There were more seizures of steroids than ice or any other drug, and there was apparently previously reported it that there was an ice epidemic in different parts of the state. So the humble Gold Coast Bulletin gave me another call sort of 5 years down the track after I finally knew what I was talking about. It was a few years of talking at conferences and publishing papers that it was a far better time to be talking about the real world implications of what we were studying. And that conversation with the paper led to a chat on ABC Radio, at the national radio station, about what the issues were. And then even in that radio interview, we started to talk a little bit more about sort of boys growing up and the pressures that they face leaving school and how things are changing so rapidly that there are a lot of pressures on young gents trying to make decisions about what their value is and where they fit in the world. And when you step outside of a high school gym where everything's sort of fun and games, it's just the guys you grew up with, and then you leave and it's a big bad world of positive pressures from giant muscular Adonises in public gyms.
Oh, of course, social media is a big one.
or normalizing that sort of body type and making it so accessible, and you feel like the guy up the street is as big as the biggest guys in a muscle magazine from back in the 80s or 90s. It's just it's all so normalized that it can be pretty confronting. And I feel for these kids, man. I'm actually quite worried about it. And the weird thing was that following that quick chat, they pulled me onto the Today Show in Australia, and then we had another chat about it. But even then, I think the radio chat was a bit more of a deep dive into the real issues, because that Today Show interview was really more so about one man's story with steroid abuse and how he'd come off of the steroids. And
right,
it's quite frustrating because it's the same message that's always purported by the media, and it's always when there's ever a discussion about steroids or even a show not long ago on ABC, actually, incidentally, again, one of those insight shows talking about steroids and the dangers, and it's always the same rhetoric. All they talk about is why do you take steroids? Would you keep taking them if you knew the risks? Here are the risks. Would you keep taking them? Yes, no. And then that's sort of the end. Thanks for coming. There's no real addressing the issue with those conversations I've had and the exposure to thousands of students teaching and seeing these new generations of kids come through over those years at uni and mentoring a couple of younger guys growing up and helping them work out where they want to go in terms of their careers. And
yes,
it's pretty clear to me, and I might be wrong, but it seems like steroid abuse is more a symptom of a problem, not the problem itself.
Okay.
You can eradicate steroid use. You can look at controlling it, and I mean, it's already a highly illegal offence to take and carry steroids in all of Australia, but all that sort of regulation isn't really addressing the reasons why men feel so compelled to put so much value on their aesthetics and how they look.
Yes.
And be willing to take such risks with that and prioritize that over other parts of life. Because that sort of obsession, and I've been through this to some degree myself growing up. It's pretty unhealthy. I was really lucky. Like, I feel like it's a lot harder to tackle this problem now, and I don't have any fixed advice on how to get around it. But I think it's only growing more and more difficult.
I think so.
You've spent some time in the gym, haven't you, James? You're pretty
well
built guy. I
certainly have a fitness journey for sure that I definitely, growing up at school, around about the time, I think, you know, Ronnie Coleman was in his prime, and I was just like this young, impressionable country kid. Oh, yeah. Well, he's a bit limpy now. He's been through a few operations, but he's still strong. I just remember seeing him and being just like so blown away by it, and then I believe he was sponsored by a supplement company called BSN or something of that nature. And through the endorsements that he was doing and everything, I was just obsessed with, you touched on the supplement companies before, I was just obsessed with buying all of those products and just hitting the weights. And I'm like, oh, it'll work. And I remember I had a cupboard full of it, and I didn't really know what it did, or, you know, I thought I had to take this before the gym, take that after the gym. And I was reading the back of it. I didn't really read the back of it. I was like, I'm sure it works. You just take it and hope for it. So it's definitely very impressionable.
I trust these guys.
Yeah,
I trust. Take advantage of me.
Yeah, of course. A young, young, impressionable kid. So I've been through that journey, mate, and I've been through a rough time where I was overweight and had to learn how to lose that weight because I felt very self-conscious. And, yeah, I've definitely been through a fitness journey as well. Absolutely.
Yeah, I bet. Well, that's the thing. We're not immune as men to pressures of body image, and that's something that they really seem to miss from the conversation in talks about body image. I've been to a couple of those sort of conferences where you talk about body dysmorphia a bit more and obesity and eating disorders, and there's always, you know, there'll be 3 days of talks about the problems that women face, which are very legitimate, but then there'll be like a couple of guys, it'll be myself and this, there's this one psychologist from Sydney who turns up as well, and it's always just a couple of us who are like, and there's a problem for men, thank you and good night. You know, it's
wow, yes.
It's not really isn't, you probably would expect it to be talked about more behind the scenes. Scientists should be communicating with each other and seeing what's going on, but it's, to be honest, on the other side, there's not much being done. And it's probably just as big an issue, and especially, how can it be evidence any better than a steroid epidemic that they revealed?
Absolutely.
That paper that interviewed me, it also interviewed the I forget what his name, he had some really badass title, but he was a police officer in some strike force for steroids seizures or something.
Sure.
He was the one revealing all the statistics. And I thought, and finally there's some numbers, hopefully this will make some of a difference, draw some attention to it. But as the media cycle works, the whole story went for about 3 minutes in the scheme of things, and then that was it, and it was the next thing.
Wow. It's certainly, I've definitely encountered a lot of blokes my age, older and younger, who were always sort of, you get that exercise and body obsession. I definitely had an exercise addiction for sure. One of my lowest moments was getting an injury some years ago, not being able to train for some 6 weeks, not even really going to be able to run. And it was a dark time for me. Like, I had to turn to meditation and podcasts, which really pulled me out of the mud. But at that point, I really realized that, it had a hold of me for sure. Like, by being obsessed with that body image, had a hold of me. And I know a lot of people are the same and going through it right now. And I still have it from time to time, for sure. I'm not perfect. So
No, none of us are, man. And I'm not, I have not been immune to those forays with body dysmorphia either. I won't go into too much detail, but something that isn't you won't find on my website, let's say, is when I was when I was much younger, when I was 18, before, okay, this is before social media and you know, before Instagram and Facebook, and I was I started out my first, I think, if you were to call it a real job back then, it seemed very real, and the pay was pretty good, but I was an underwear model for there was a television campaign on that ran on all the major networks and things, and they did print, and I had my own sort of pair of underwear, and back then it was a pretty big campaign.
I remember that, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, I remember that. And, that's awesome.
Yeah, it got a bit of controversy. It was a TV commercial, and we threw cream pies at each other. It was like a dozen models, and we all, it was pretty risque. Yeah, it's deleted from the internet in pretty much every way now, thank God.
Wow.
But, it was before YouTube as well, so we're pretty,
yeah, okay. So it's just like a bit erased. That doesn't happen these days. Nothing can be erased from the internet.
No, good luck. If anything's, yeah, everything's permanent now. But
oh yeah,
that was. It's probably some terrible photo with me and some.
Yeah, but it's like, I'm going to go dig and try and find this.
Well, you won't recognize me if you see it. I was, man, was I skinny? I didn't have that pressure to be bigger back then.
It
was,
yes.
I actually felt closer to like a female, and more typically female associated eating disorder, and I did very much at all. It's the first time I ever auditioned for anything like that, and I rocked up, and it was such a confronting interview, man. And we walked, it was up in Brisbane, a bit of a trip for us from the Gold Coast, about an hour or so, and then got to this director's studio, which was basically a house like in Brisbane, one of these Queenslander homes, this timber homes,
yep,
on stilts. And I literally walked in, and the first thing I saw was a giant video camera, something that looked pretty professional from a TV studio, but it was pointed 45 degrees down at the ground at a mattress on the floor.
Huh.
And I thought, yeah, okay, I don't think I signed up for this video.
A little bit of worry and, came over you.
Yeah, as an 18-year-old kid, I even like,
for sure,
wasn't the cleverest kid, but I, you know, they had a quick chat with someone who I thought was the director, who turned out to be like an assistant, and the director's over there, and I didn't really understand how the whole thing was working, but I put on a pair of underwear, and I was in fairly good shape there from years of rowing, and I was just sort of luckily in fairly good shape. I never really tried that hard at looking good. I just wanted to be a good rower. And then, yeah, so then there was, you know, all these other models turned up, and they showed us what they wanted, and I had to roll around with some lady I'd never met within 2 minutes of shaking her hand, and it was a really strange sort of audition. And I've had to sort of unpack that from my memories just recently. I've been writing a bit of an essay on how all that came together. But then, wow, that led to the two of us actually getting parts in the campaign, and it became this big thing, and they paid us more than people should get paid for that time. It was a lot of money.
Yeah.
And then, the weird thing was, after they called me to say, yeah, you got the part, it was that the end of that conversation, which was pretty brief, but the end of that conversation was, yeah, you've got the role, you've got I think it was 6 weeks or 8 weeks, you've got 6 weeks to get in shape,
huh,
thanks. And then that was it. And then I thought, what the, I was probably, look, I, and it's not something I normally talk about, I walk around at probably 85 kilos these days, and I'm in fairly typical shape. But back then, I was already about 70, 75 kilos. And I haven't really grown up or in any, I haven't developed much since age 18, man. I sort of stopped there. I sort of peaked there. So right now, it'd be like me being 70, 75, 77 kilos now. But anyway, I became obsessed with this last part of that conversation, and getting in shape, like I was going to be exposed and under cameras and embarrassed if I got to this end of this 6 weeks, and, you know, I was going to be on television and not be in shape, or I was going to get there with all these other models that I'd never met before, with this already the sense of imposter syndrome, because it was my first job, and all these people I presumed would have had more experience in this space, and I had all of these fears about getting there and being cast away and not being in shape. I don't know what that, just being in shape was the weirdest, most ambiguous term ever, but I basically just stopped eating.
Wow.
It was weird. It's a weird thing to think about doing now, but I just, yeah, I was like chewing food and spitting it out. There was no, it wasn't, It's probably somewhere on the spectrum of wasn't anything as extreme as what we typically think of as bulimia. But it was, oh man, it was such a strange thing. And then it didn't seem too strange, probably to the people who were exposed to different parts of it. But I'd train and run and be at the gym 7 days a week, three times a week. And unfortunately, after the shoot, which was a couple of days, it didn't stop there. It took quite a while for me to realize how unhealthy all of that was. It was sort of the beginnings of being obsessed with how much, and it's I think it's pretty common for guys, but that look down at your stomach, because that's where we store fat, and making sure that was as flat or as like rippled with muscles as possible.
Yes.
And man, it was just, yes, crippling. And I think the only thing that saved me, and I'm so glad there wasn't like a social media platform to make things worse, but back then, just getting back into sport and into a sport that required me to be strong and actually healthy, getting into surf boat rowing, which,
yes,
if you've got American listeners, they probably don't even know what that is. It's worldwide a big
just sport. Google surf boat rowing and you'll see how crazy it is.
it's an insane sport.
Yes.
I wouldn't recommend it to anyone.
Oh,
but
wow.
it's awesome.
Dude, sport. It almost killed me for sure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. It's pretty extreme, man. But yeah, that required you to be pretty strong, right? Like those boats were 200, 300 kilos dry.
Absolutely.
And then you've
absolutely
got four people in it, and you're trying to row that essentially a whaling boat into the surf and over the surf. And
big surf condition. Up and back, yes.
And you cannot be a little guy there. You get demolished.
Absolutely.
You've got to lift. You become this essentially like a weightlift, like a power lifter in the ocean. It's crazy. But so that like pulled me out of it, because I just couldn't sustain training. I couldn't get through that sort of training and, meet up with the guys and enjoy that component of life if I didn't just eat normally.
Get on the beef. And absolutely.
And that was the only way out. I don't think I would have been, I don't know how I would have found a way out of that, because I didn't realize it was that much of an issue back then. There wasn't much of media attention on poor boys not eating well enough. It was, that wasn't really a conversation. So I don't know,
yes.
I'm really grateful. But now, yeah, that's why I feel like there's such a bigger potential issue to address for young men growing up.
Absolutely, mate. Absolutely. It's interesting. Thank you for sharing that, Dan. I certainly had my own journey as well, probably opposite to that, where I, after school, because I was in boarding school, and I just ate and ate and ate, because we did so much sport. It was either rugby or rowing or whatever we were doing. And then as soon as I moved out or finished school, like the food remained, but all the sports stopped. Like I was still going to the gym and everything, but my obsession was just to be heavy. Like it was just to be heavy and lift heavy, and didn't matter what I ate. I was like, I just needed to get there. It was all about what number I could tell you when some people would say, how much do you weigh, bro? And I think at my peak weight, I was at, 137 kilos or something ridiculous like that. And I was, I at the time I thought it was great. Looking back at photos now, it's disgusting, but at the time I thought it was great. I was getting stronger and I was eating terrible food. I think I was just full-time dirty bulk. And I think one of the defining moments for me, Dad, actually was not like yours, but I think I had a breakup with a girl at the time or something like that. And I think from there I was like, stuff it, I'm going to lose all this weight, I don't give a shit, I'm going to get fit and whatever. And from then on in, that's what pulled me out. And I didn't use any flashy supplements. I didn't use any flashy trainers or nutrition plans. It was all trial and error. And looking back, it made me stronger, as I'm sure it did yourself going through that.
That's it. Well, a blessing in disguise, that girl breaking your little heart, James.
Ah, oh, it is.
By mate. The sounds of things. that is. It sounds like almost the complete other end of the spectrum of what I was going through. But that's it. That was also what made it. We obviously both recovered from that time, but it was kind of simpler then too. We're talking about getting as, you wanted to get as heavy as you could, and I wanted to get as small as I could. That's sort of how complex it gets for many in sort of female eating disorders as well, wanting to get as small as possible. And then now when we're looking at the complexities of the normalized male physique, you know, in the modern sense, it's far more complicated. It's not about losing, you know, being small or being big. It's about being as big as possible and then being as small as possible in other areas and being super strategic about your eating and your training and every part of your life to attain something like that. And for most guys, you have a pretty fixed genetic potential in a lot of those ways, at least. Yes. Sort of a launching pad of a genetic potential. And then that was actually something my app addressed back way back when, but
good old app.
It was a calculator actually that worked on the morphology of your bones and could calculate what that genetic potential really was and how close were to that without steroids and things. And it was an app that I used for research as well to get some information from people to see whether or not they were closer or further away from what their potential could be. You could actually derive all of these algorithms back from people who were natural bodybuilders and had gotten to as big as they possibly could, and all of their morphometric, like all of their measurements from their bones, could actually be turned into algorithms to work out how big they could possibly get. So we sort of reverse engineered that and turned it into a bit of a calculator. And it was nice because it sort of showed you how close you really were, and it took away that pressure of feeling like you weren't good enough as well for most people. And that's something we learned from that research. But anyway, with the sort of redirecting back to that issue of how complex it is to get that physique, that seemingly unattainable physique today, that's where those pressures of I feel like I've gotten as far as I possibly can in the gym or changing the ways that I've eaten, I've tried everything. You know, how do I get to look like that guy who, you know, every other measure is very similar to me. He's my age. He's walking in the gym the same. He's, you know, wears the same clothes as me. He lives in the same, you know, the same area. Why don't I look like that without realizing that just how likely it is that those people are actually taking some sort of substance that's giving them a bit of an edge?
And yes.
People get annoyed when you say things like that because there are people who are naturally look amazing and they feel like you're devaluing what they're doing. But again, that sort of back and forth small talk isn't really the issue. It's that what we're really talking about here is how we find this need to, well, this value on our aesthetic that seems to trump everything else that should be important in life.
Yes.
And not having the right reasons or motivations to look that way. Like, I think the happiest I ever was and the best shape I was ever in was just when I wasn't even caring about what I looked like and I was just training and enjoying that sporting and sporting life. And everybody has different experiences, sure.
Absolutely.
But, there are other things. Like, if I have a chat to a guy now and over those years of chatting to guys in the gyms, if they ask me, oh, man, I'm thinking about starting this or... No, I've taken these before. And I want to do this. Like, why? Like, what are the risks? You know, generally, I was the risk guy, is trying to talk people out of it. But that doesn't do anything.
Their minds that, already made up, aren't they? When they come to you, they're like, "I'm doing it. Just make me feel a bit better about it."
That's it. It's basically depending on how you handle that conversation as the advisor, and it's generally, well, what are the risks that I will definitely need to worry about when I definitely take this substance I'm talking to you about? You know, it's just, I would just want to know, you know, it's not so much talk me out of it. But what I ended up working towards just sort of organically, and this wasn't like an active plan of changing my tact, but it seemed to be when we had conversations about why people wanted to consider something like this or why it was so important to look that great, started to work out that there wasn't really a purpose and people were generally quite caught up in this quite maddening cycle of training as hard as you can, feeling more inadequate when you're comparing yourself to a different level of peers, and then training as hard as you can and then getting to a level where you're still feeling inadequate to the next level of people with a slightly more finely tuned physique, and just working out whether or not there was something else you could be spending your time doing or focusing on. And generally, that was the problem, was these guys didn't really have much of a, I don't know, some there is a lot of like blue collar and white collar guys out there that are, you know, working their asses off all day and then just want to look great as well, and they're single or they're trying to just look as good as they can, and it's a part of a sort of a fairly balanced lifestyle, and that's that's, you know, that makes sense, and it's healthy, and it's not debilitating in any way. So you wouldn't call it a problem. But for a lot of guys growing up who have just sort of been thrown into the gyms and don't leave the gym, you know, it's not like they don't develop this other sense of social purpose, this utility in society that gives them a reason to do something else or forget about the gym on a day, and not wake up thinking about just how their stomach looks or how big their arms are. Like I think that's kind of the trap, especially for young guys who are jumping out of school and seeing all the shirtless guys on all around them. And it's a bit of a trap, and that's where I think discussions of masculinity and what's, you know, what a man's purpose can be or should be, all the different, you know, the different fields of potential that we have as young men. I think that's a healthy discussion that doesn't really, I think, as a part of other conversations about equality and things that are, you know, just as important and legitimate. I think a bit of silencing has occurred on, or muting of conversations where we're discussing what boys can become and should be considering and what they want to do with life. You know, they've kind of taken a back seat for a while, and that's, you know, it serves some purpose. But I think we can't forget about these young men who are still quite desperate for some direction in life, and you know, where they still have a meaning, and helping them find that meaning and the things that they enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's a real tough one. It's really hard to really define what we can do to help these young men growing up not to feel like the world revolves around having this perfect body image and all that social media content and I don't know, movies as well, like The Rock is swole as hell and everyone loves him, and like everyone's like, oh, I want to be as big as him, or who else have we got, Jason Statham, or all the big wigs that everyone idolizes is quite fit. Like, I'm not sure there are any action heroes who look like Woody Allen or something like that.
Well, there's been a bit of a jettisoning, a huge rise in these superhero films as well, man.
And absolutely.
Those characters are typically skinny 18-year-olds. It's tough. There's definitely these pressures. I don't, like, all of those things maybe contribute to very small percentages to the problem, but they're all collectively. It's quite an interesting time to grow up, and I don't think I definitely don't claim to have any answers or any grip of what the actual problems are, what needs to be addressed. But I do think the conversations about what decisions boys are making and growing up is something that they would get a lot out of, and you know, that's something that I'd like to encourage with parents and things. We're actually looking at speaking to a couple of schools either this year or next year. And talking to parents about these sorts of things, because there's not really much of a platform or forum for parents to talk about
the
boys and what life's like now for a young man.
Yeah, so it should be, I suppose it's something that should be added to the curriculum in some way, I suppose. How do you define what it's called?
At least to that stage of life, somewhere around school hours or something, talking to the parents, talking to the boys. I mean, we both went to all boys schools, right? So we're familiar with, you know, everything was about the boys in those schools. But and then we were lucky to have, you know, there was a lot of support for parents, and there was nice talks, and they did have a lot of sort of, not counseling, but they did have, that conversation was started there. But I think it's a little bit less specific in potentially like co-ed institutions, and you know, you talk about students in a general sense, and especially now where there are some it's quite a delicate conversation to have when you're comparing men and women and trying to acknowledge differences there. I think it's something that we can all sort of contribute to a little in a little part, or maybe some greater part, through your podcasts and through talking with young men and sharing their stories, man. That's
absolutely.
I think it's good to, you know, it's healthy to know that you're not all, you know, your experience isn't necessarily that different from other men. And
yes,
some of the people, and I think one of the most valuable things that I've learned in recent years is that those idols, you know, those people you really look up to and have tried to perhaps your mentors or people you've strived to be more like when you start to learn more about them, or you can see so much more about someone's life now when, you know, through how much people share, you know, even these public figures through social media and things. It's so interesting to see how normal all of these people are, and they're as talented as they might be in one area. Like they all have the same struggles. We all have the same. We all go through the same things, and I think that sort of normalizing of fame and sort of tearing down of idols a little bit, and just sort of remembering that we're all on the same platform and we're not disadvantaged or no one's really. I mean, it's a bold statement, but we're all disenfranchised to some extent in some very specific ways. But then we have these opportunities and these potential leverage points in other places of life. And comparing yourself strictly to one person and all of their opportunities and limitations is silly. But it's getting that breadth of understanding of what can be achievable across lots of different people, and understanding that your very unique story is going to be, it's going to be a complex balance of sort of navigating through your own limitations and what's not working for you and where your potential really lies. That's a bit of a lesson to work through as a young guy.
Absolutely. And a young woman. Absolutely, absolutely. It's amazing that whenever I've listened to an interview or a story or a podcast about a high level person and they are willing to share a vulnerable moment of theirs, it does kind of make you feel, oh, so they've been on the same level as me, and they can show vulnerability, and you can kind of connect with those people, and I think that really helps people. So, but yeah, absolutely.
But there's some structuring too. You do sometimes hear interviews with people who there's definitely, and I'll try to steer clear of any sort of political leaning. But there's definitely a tendency to sometimes blame erroneous factors, external factors in life, and when things do go wrong, and you have your own narrative about adversity or some experience you've had. When you ask somebody that question, as you have quite a few people that have listened to on your podcast, the different reactions and the way that they're told tells you a lot about where that person is right now and how they handle adversity and
absolutely
sort of direction. And when you can ask anybody about like things that have happened to them or some sort of low point perhaps, it's amazing what I think, and I could be wrong, but what I tend to observe is when you do find those highly productive people, those stories about what's happened to them, they're more about their responsibility in the situation, more about what they contributed to the problem and what they took from it, instead of blaming other people and blaming other factors and sort of being a victim of their circumstance. I think, I'm not sure if it was on your podcast or some other, but talking about, you know, how this terrible things have happened to me and I hate these people were terrible to me and this was hard. That sort of use of language is quite revealing, I think. I don't think there's anything in life that isn't been a very valuable lesson that I was definitely partly responsible for. And I think taking responsibility for those sort of
absolutely
problems that you've encountered and mistakes you've made is healthy. Like, it's okay to make mistakes, and not trying to shift that blame to someone else is one of the most important things. Taking responsibility for where you're at, where you're going, and what's happened so far. You know, owning all of that. You've got to own your sort of your failures as much as you own your successes.
Certainly.
And if you blame everybody for all the hard things that have happened to you, you can blame them all for any win you've ever had too, because that's sort of how the world works. It's not, you can't cherry pick. So
that's right.
So that attitude's quite, I think that's something I've found has been pretty interesting to observe in those.
Yeah.
You know, the Tim Cooks and the people at the upper echelons of productivity.
Yes. Yeah, it's interesting. It's such a valid point. I've spoken to a lot of people and just asked them about their journey in life and where they are. And there's a select few that own everything as to where they are. And then there's always the odd one that says, oh, because of this, or I'm like, oh, why don't you run with that idea because that's what you want to do? And they're like, I can't because of this, this, and that, and the other. or whatever it may be. They don't want to sort of, oh, it's like, oh, there might not be an idea because of this, or I can't because I did this, or whatever. It's just, yeah, it's definitely just taking ownership. Like I'd take ownership of everything that I am up until now, for sure. So
yeah, well, that's it. Well, and I don't know. I think one of the lucky, yeah, I don't think that's anything special about any of my stories or where I've come from, where I'm going, man. But I think I have been very lucky in that I've never identified with some group that was, you know, that was disenfranchised in any way. Like, you know, I've never, like, my dad left when I was really young, but I never felt or associated with the, you know, the single parent group. You know, I never felt like that was, oh no, I'm a single parent, I'm destined to be a certain type of person. I never felt like I was a part of that group. I never felt like, as a scholarship boy, like, we didn't have much money when dad left. Life was, you know, things changed very rapidly, and we couldn't afford high school. I had to get scholarships to school, and I ended up getting 6 different scholarships to different schools, and then picked the Southport school.
Wow.
But that was like, I never associated or felt like I was a part of this group of, you know, poor kids who are, you know, even though I was surrounded by pretty extreme wealth at that school, and as you are at all these private boys' colleges, like, I never felt like, just because, you know, I didn't have these certain things, or I'd grown up playing with secondhand toys, like that,
yeah,
or any of those sort of stuff. That's not, I mean, I appreciate anyone thinking, yeah, oh, cry me a river, man. Like, you had the opportunity to have a nice education and all this sort of stuff.
Yes. But,
like, I never really associated with any of these groups. And, you know, I had some pretty extreme, we spent a lot of time in Saudi Arabia growing up, sort of back and forth in Dubai. And part of one of the, let's say traditional parts of Saudi Arabia growing up, the capital in Riyadh. And, you know, there's some confronting experiences there. And there was, you know, there was a violence and, you know, there was car bombings and, you know, being abused by police and having guns at your temple and all this sort of stuff at, you know, age 10.
Wow.
And that's, like, I never really felt like I associated with this group of people who had some horrible trauma and were never going to get over that. Like, I never, and all of these experiences felt like they revealed a new opportunity. Whenever something weird and strange happens like that, you think, wow, that's really unique. Where's the opportunity in that? How do I sort of, it's not as aggressive as how do I leverage this, but it's like, how do I, does this mean for me now? I, you know, that changes things a little bit. Sure. That's yes. Cool. There's definitely some terrifying moments in there, whatever. What have I learned from it, and how does that make me more unique as an individual? What can I now contribute to society in a different way? Or how does that knowledge feed into wisdom and my ability to make an impact somehow? Like, that's always been my process, even as a, you know, as a really young kid. Like, all the way through. And I don't know, I think that's just luck, because I don't really hear that all the time.
You
know,
no.
People talk about, you know, one aspect of, say, that all those different factors, you know, having one, you know, not having both parents around, and that being the reason why nothing's ever going to happen. Like, you know, well, dad left and life's really difficult now, and that's it. I never really had someone to show me how to shave and this and that. Like, yeah, okay.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Did you work that out? The shaving's not hard, man.
Like, absolutely, yeah. Mate. Absolutely.
Like, the benefits, and I don't look. I'm not gonna. It'd be really weird of me to say that there was something wrong with having both parents, but there are benefits to having one. You know, there's pros and cons. Sure, you know, everybody wants to have two parents around. It's beautiful to have two parents who stay together forever. You have your parents are together, aren't they?
Yes, absolutely, Dan. Yeah, they've been together 40-odd years. It's amazing. That's true love to me, those two. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's beautiful, man. And that's exactly what, you know, I still strive for, even though I didn't see that growing up. I think that's
me too, mate. Very attainable
thing. But as a kid, you learn from your adversity more than you do your you know, your privileges and
yes,
good luck. And man, I was lucky growing up. I didn't have one male role model. You know, I didn't have a guy who told me who I needed to be. And you probably didn't either. But something that I, like, you probably picked just as much as I did. Mm. But I really took advantage of this potential to find my own father figures in certain ways. Didn't know I was doing that as I went through. But I kind of cherry picked the best parts of all these guys who are around me. Mm. I like that about this guy, and, like, you know, this teacher or this supervisor or this boss or these people that I really admired, and
I was lucky to be, I mean, I could have had terrible people around me for sure, but I didn't. So I was really lucky in that respect. But I got to, I really got to shape myself and take control over who, you know, as best I could with my surroundings. I got to sort of pick what I wanted to, who I wanted to learn from and who I wanted to surround myself with. And, you know, there's no real expectations put on me by my dad. There's no real, one father figure. And I got to grow up really, really quickly, thankfully. So when dad left when I was younger, you know, the man of the house from the age of, I wasn't that young, 10, but, you know, going into high school, like I got to learn how to fix things. I studied engineering while I was at high school to learn how to fix enough of the, like, electrical engineering so I could fix things around the house and service the cars and look after, you know, look after the family and talk about finances from a young age. And you might not necessarily have all that if you'd never had, you know, you've never included in those conversations, or you know, mum never needed help. You know, there's definitely, you can whinge and complain that you had to talk about finances. Mm-hmm. You can say, I got to talk about finances growing up.
Yes.
You know, and yeah, I think there's just so much beauty to all of these different experiences, and it's really just how you retell them. And if you can take charge of that narrative and you're writing it, and that's something I found just writing some of these stories, it surprised me how I interpreted all of them very similarly. Like every little story of it, you know, adversity or some sort of smackdown, or I had medical issues as well when I was growing through high school and when I was younger. I have a anatomical problem with my kidneys.
Oh.
That made things really painful. But like all those little things, it was always the same response. And I don't think it wasn't a learned thing. Like I don't remember the point where I went from being the victim of all my consequences to someone who, you know, saw all the good in all the difficult times. And it's just something that I seem to have. So maybe that's just luck, man. But I think that's great, something, man, that certainly can be learnt. And I think it's a pretty positive way of looking at life. But I don't know if it's the only way or the right way. But it's definitely worked for me in some pretty interesting circumstances.
That is great, mate. And I'm hoping anyone listening can sort of learn from that anything that life throws at you, it's a great way. What you said is that, how can this make me better? How can I learn from this? And how can I utilize this to move forward to become better, mate? I think that's absolutely phenomenal, for sure. You should be commended for that outlook. It's amazing. So,
but like I say, man, it's not, I didn't pick it. I don't deserve any accolades. it's just how it is. I'm just grateful that that's how I approach things. But
that's good.
I know that there's, you know, there's some pretty horrible things that people go through in life.
Mm.
And, you know, when they all sort of mount up, it can be pretty hard to find a way out and feel hopeless. And that, I've gone through those sorts of periods too, where things are pretty heavy and you've got to make some big decisions and change things radically, and it feels good to get that progress back. And I think progress is a massive part, like feeling progress and feeling steps forward in some direction is such a huge, just a huge requirement for humans, or at least myself. Like, it's just such an important thing. So taking some big steps, like you would, taking massive steps at the minute. Where are you today? You're in LA.
Yeah, I'm in LA today, mate. Yeah, no, my this journey has been an interesting one. I went over to Canada, thought I was going to work there, excuse me, and realized that I went to Calgary. Calgary was, wasn't what I thought it was going to be. So I'm like, I didn't leave the beautiful Gold Coast and a great job to just settle in Calgary. So I was like, I'll go to Vancouver. Vancouver was beautiful. I spent a lot of time in Calgary because I thought I was going to be there for a bit. So I sort of ran out of time, but I thought, you know what? I'm writing it off as a learning experience, and I've started the podcast during the journey, and I've met a lot of people and done a lot of fun stuff. And yeah, from here, I'm in LA until the 1st of July, and then I go on to whatever the next journey will be. So we'll soon find, I'll soon figure out what that will be. So it's exciting, but daunting.
But what better way to see what's out there than just get out there?
That's it, mate. Awesome. You just got to take the leap every now and then. But I'm conscious of your time, Dan. Do you have much time at the moment, mate?
Yeah, we've got a little bit. I've got to shoot off to
shoot off
the directions.
To your work. No, of course, mate. If you don't mind, we can have a crack at a few of these questions I'd love to ask you, and then we can have a quick run over your book that's going to come out soon, and then go from there. Does that sound good?
Sure, man. Hit me with the list.
Awesome, mate. With my list of questions, which I just find
it's pretty. Yeah, give me my best attempt at an answer.
That's fine, mate. There's no right or wrong. So, what is one of your biggest goals right now?
Biggest goals right now,
or a goal, any type of goal. fitness, personal, career, anything?
Yeah, well, it might feed in a little bit to what I'm doing in writing now, but I've done quite a bit of writing in my short career so far. But I mean, the PhD thesis was 64,000 words or something. But the papers in there sort of individually, and like any scientist would be the same, or probably far more experienced for the majority of them. You know, like you do a lot of writing and a lot of rewriting and a lot of proofing, and those documents isn't nothing like, you know, when you publish a scientific article, it's not something that you can write once and go, I'll just spell check this and we're done. This goes through, you know, so many rounds and rounds of rewriting and editing, and then you send it off, and then the journals come back and tell you to change it, and then you send it off again and they tell you to change it. You know, that can go back and forth. But then just sharing with all the authors, and it being such a collaborative thing, like everybody's got some sort of way of doing things differently, and they all sort of nitpick in different ways and have valid contributions. There's a lot of writing there. But what I'm starting to do now, which is a little bit different, is having I guess comparatively a bit more of a creative approach to writing in my sort of my downtime between different parts of work. So I'm writing about these stories a little bit more, like the ones that we've been talking about today. There's a little sort of a bit of a deeper dive into each of them, and writing these essays as they are at the moment, that'll slowly come together as a bit of a book. That's the sort of the ultimate goal at some stage, is to put these into a context that's actually quite valuable. Like, I don't think that I have any special insight into how to do things right, but I think if I can be at least honest with myself and honest with different parts of how I've responded to things, or know other people and how they've responded to things, that can at least potentially shine some light on the value of different things that at least have specific to my life and my story. And you know, I think there is some insight in there, because I've had a bit of a mixed bag of experiences from, I mean, I am a researcher and a scientist, but I've also owned a handful of businesses and a couple of companies all the way through my studies as well. So I've had done a couple of different things, and I've had sort of this double life for the majority of my adult life. So there's sort of two sides to that coin.
What did you want to be when you were growing up?
A writer, actually.
Interesting.
I love the idea of the lifestyle. And sort of that, this romanticized vision of sort of writing in a cottage I was still doing up, or some sort of like small cabin in Italy or something. And that I just spent my days writing and thinking and reflecting on life.
It's cool, mate. And now the next one is, if you had a moment in life that you could possibly undo or change, what would that moment be and why?
It's a great question, and I don't think I would change anything.
That's a great answer.
I don't know. That regret's not a word I've used. I've made tons of mistakes, and I've, you know, some of those have been at the cost of other people, and I'd like feel terrible about that. But even in those sort of isolated incidents, it's like, it's all been so important and formative to who I've become, people around me have become. Like, it's like I've had people do me wrong as well. Like, there's been some, you know, not everybody treats everybody fairly, and that's fine, but it's like, you know, accept all of that. And I think we've all done the right thing, and I've got a bit of a deterministic philosophy of life, and sort of everything is sort of preset, pre-going anyway.
Yes.
We're kind of observing it as we go. We're just along for the ride in many ways.
Oh, that's good.
We're just trying to understand as much as we can. But I think that part of that philosophy, which isn't a practical philosophy day to day, but part of that is sort of just appreciating all of those different moments that, you know, all the way through life, and how important they are to wherever you're going. And without any of them, if I changed anything, who knows what would have
that's so true
changed.
It's so true. It's a question that I've been mulling over a lot, because we are all on this path, and I've had some crappy times, but I'm glad those times happened, for sure. Like, I'm so happy, or 100%. Else I wouldn't be in the mind frame that I'm in now. You never know where else you might have gone, but either way, yeah, life's beautiful as we are at the moment. So I'll have to reconsider that question. But anyway, we'll go to...
I'm thankful for all of my mistakes as much as I am all of the things that I did right. And to be honest, I probably can't even remember most of the things I did do right. They didn't really change my life that much. It's the things that really changed who I am are the mistakes I made, and those sort of lessons and the
the harder times.
It's funny how it's shaped like that, isn't it? That you remember more the mistakes than the... They sort of stick with you more. You mull over them a lot more. So, but yeah, I guess that's it.
Putting natural. Together a resume is one of the hardest things I ever do. Like if I've got to put a resume together or put together a website or remember what I did this year that was worth telling people, like the good things.
Yeah.
Man, that's tough.
Anyone you apply for a job to, just go, hey, just search dandonna.com and they'll be like, yeah, you're hired. No worries, mate.
Nah, man, it's not. I wish it was that easy.
Jeez. Everyone listening, go to that website. Now, what's the next one here? If you could choose one thing, just one thing to change about the world, what would it be? Or society or politics or anything?
I think it stems a little bit from that victimhood trap, but I think encouraging sort of intellectual conversation and never, like if I could take away everybody's impulsion to silence somebody when they're talking or like so that my opinion is worth more than yours or having that permanence of opinion, like I'm willing to change my mind about pretty much everything that I think I know and understand. And that's a part of being a scientist to some degree and it's just a part of personal philosophy, but like anyone can change my mind on pretty much anything. And I think there's a lot of that out there, but there's a little bit of, you know, when people get really caught up and, you know, there's, you can't blame them for that. That's, you know, things have happened to them too. But if you could remove that element of just that compulsion to not listen anymore, you know, to not take in new information and actually weigh it out without bias and not be stuck in your own ways. Like I think that's really important in any conversation and in any forum to learn and move forward, to not just be there to be right, but to be there to find the truth in the conversation and work out, you know, what the truth is rather than who's right and wrong. It's never a battle in discussions, but it seems to be, and especially with, if you've ever been on the Twitter sphere, man, that place is hectic. Like you can't say anything there without someone thinking that they have an opposite opinion to you when you have exactly the same opinions. I steer pretty clear of it, but yeah, that if I could change anything, it's just I had to remove that human capacity to stop critically thinking about their own opinions and be willing to throw them to the wind when they find better evidence or find better rationality.
Absolutely, no, that's a great one. Now, how would you define true happiness to you? What's your version of true happiness?
I think that's probably a longer question to unpack. To sort of values and sort of how you value yourself. But I think I recently heard, I'll give you this, I've recently heard that a pretty good interpretation of what happiness is. And on sort of a micro level, I thought this was fairly clever and fairly apt, but where you... happiness in a day, sort of day-to-day basis, is getting to the end of the day or getting through a day with as little requirement to do those things that you're avoiding or don't want to do that are sort of weighing you down. Like if you get to the end of the day and you didn't have to do that today or this didn't come up and cause you issues, like that's a bit of a, that can sometimes be a pretty amazing day. Well, at least in at the moment for me, there's quite a bit of juggling and still quite a few different lives. Even within the job, I've got the 25 different research projects that I work on concurrently. And just, you know, there's so many different little nuances to each one of those projects and different people involved, and everything's quite hard to manage. But you're getting to the end of the day where there's not a catastrophe or some terrible thing happens or something that needs correcting and all of your time and attention. If you get to the end of the day and you've actually put your attention on things that you enjoy and you haven't been a source of conflict or anything, everybody's been quite happy. It's a very pretty basic premise, I suppose. But
no, that's good.
At the moment, it's the absence of that sort of that one thing you really don't want to do today.
No, that's good, mate. And the next one is, I suppose this is for, I need to have a double look at these questions. But in your own definition, sort of why. This is a heavy question. Why do we exist on this planet? What do you think that us as humans, what are we here to do? Like what is our purpose here to do as a society?
I think the philosophy I apply to that sort of larger scale question is not as
uplifting as probably the rest of my like functional philosophies for day to day in my life. I think as a species, we're a speck. I read a book when I was really young. We went back to Sydney for a funeral, my first funeral. I'd never been. That was quite a confronting little trip. But I took this book with me called The Consolations of Philosophy by Alan de Botton. It was really interesting. It sort of talked you through how all these really, in a beautiful and eloquent way, how all these old philosophers explained things that are quite relevant in a modern context as well, and how they can console you through different situations. And I became, for whatever reason, I became obsessed with philosophy and tried to work out what I felt about it. And it turns out, if I was to put a name on it, it's probably closest to what they call determinism or fatalism. That sort of note. I am everything that I am, and everything that happens in my life is a product of my biology and the experiences that I have, right? So the things that happen around me and what I was born with, and
wow.
Neither of those things I have any control over.
Yes.
If you think of it. And I won't go this because it kind of really unravels or undoes everything else that I actually apply to day-to-day life. But I think that, because I do feel like, and it's, I think it's important at a functional level to assume control over life, at least approach life with that way. But I think as a species, the purpose of man is to have some time on this planet. I mean, I think I'm sure if the dinosaurs were capable of it, or any one of these little species that sort of reflect on and off the billion year timeline of the recent billion years, they all were sort of inconsequential. So it's pretty hard to like be aware of where we've come from, how old bacteria are, and feel like we're actually some relevant part of universal history, which is pretty unlikely in the scheme of things. There's you talk to a bacteriologist, like a person who studies bacteria, and you'll hear how old some of these bacteria are and how much they predate us, and you start to think that's pretty strange that we consider ourselves, you know, the primary being containing lots of bacteria, and it's not these huge universes or planets of bacteria riding on us, and we're just this very simple planet, you know, to them. You know, we definitely weren't the first ones here.
No.
And that sort of perspective on how big we are to bacteria, and how those, you know, they outnumber us in every one of our bodies. I don't know how many, it's more than 10 to 1. It's huge, you know, their cells to our cells. And that sort of perspective, and the perspective of looking outwards throughout the universe, I don't think there's much of an actual purpose. I don't know. That's probably not the question, like the answer you're looking for.
No, that's all right.
As far as sort of, as far as humans go, man, that broad, I think we're just a dot.
We are in the time scale of the world and life and creation, like we are just a speck, like our lifetime, just a speck in amongst the billions of years of animals and creation, I suppose, isn't it? Or some degree, as I'm learning.
That's it, man. A really good book I'm actually reading at the moment called, it's probably influenced my answer somewhat. It's called The Next Species, and it's this paleontologist guy, who's a guy who's obsessed with paleontology, at least, walking through like these sort of valleys and mountain ranges and stuff out in the States. And how you can literally just walk up the side of a mountain and see like whole eras of existence within like a couple of feet of fossilization, and how you can see like this was a however many millions of years, and this is where
between
this meter, this height, and then we walk up another 10 meters, like that's a whole, that's all dinosaurs, that's all trees, that's all this, that's all that, the next level, and that's all like, it's just insane that even on this planet, like we'll be reduced to a ring around the Earth at some stage. It's pretty bleak.
The Next Species, everyone, get that book out. That's very interesting,
though. An uplifting read.
Yeah. Wow. When we think about, that's amazing. No, that's really good. Now, the next one is a bit of an interesting one. When was the last time you got really upset or mad, and why? What was it about?
Oh, I don't know. I think that being angry since I was a pubescent.
True.
A bit frustrated probably by some things, but it's pretty easy to rationalize away from that sort of stuff pretty quickly and work out. I don't know. I'm painfully calm, and I get called that quite a lot.
So people try to rile you up and they don't get much out of you.
Yeah, well, even in like terrible situations, I had a pretty decent car crash, a 6-car pileup a couple of years ago, and I was just in the middle of it, you know, just sitting, and then some massive car behind pushes me into all these other cars, and people at the front were, you know, in terrible way, and I'm somehow in the middle, safely in my Jeep. Thank you, American cars. I was all right, but getting out of that, man, it was just like everyone's screaming and it's raining, and I'm the guy that walks around with the little notepad and the umbrella, like, yeah, just put all your details on here, I'll, you know, spread it around. And I was in the car with somebody, and they were just like, "What the? Like, just react, man."
Just like, react.
I react to a lot of things. Like, I get happy and excited about a million things a day, and you know, there's some terrible things that I acknowledge. But when things are really, they get to that level where you could probably approach anger, you know, that sort of manifests something as extreme, I think, as anger. Yeah, that I go the opposite direction. I go super calm.
Like, that's okay, good.
Well, how? I don't like this feeling. How do I? What's the logic at play here? And how do I? What's the most important? Just reprioritize and see where I am. But yeah, I don't get anger. But I'm still a kid at some stage. But angry because I'm like angry about anything growing up. Testosterone's a terrible thing.
Oh God, how easy was it for us to flip a switch in teenage years? Yeah. I think I remember when puberty kicked in, and I just became such a pissed off little bastard.
Yeah. Well, that's it. I think it's before like different parts of your brain have really developed, like that prefrontal lobe and all that, all these different ways of like moderating your emotions and being a little bit more logical in your conduct. And I think testosterone on its own, man, by the way, steroid research and steroids, I have no negative opinions of them. Just before I forget, like they can treat an endless list of diseases in different ways, and they're amazing. And testosterone by itself is not a villain, and neither is it like something that makes men inherently evil or, you know, terrible, angry people. I don't think that at all, and I don't for that to be a misconception of what I'm saying. But testosterone, when you're adjusting to these spikes and levels of it when you're much, much younger, it's difficult. But when you're older, man, you're responsible for your stuff. You're responsible all the way through, but your testosterone's no excuse to not applying logic to things, you know. It's not an excuse for men to be a certain way.
Oh,
at all.
Yeah, no, of course. Oh, you mean if guys were to take steroids and they had
guys were to take steroids, or even just men in general, in these discussions about the differences between men and women and sort of how our hormones change us or our priorities in life and systemic sort of issues and things, I think that kind of corrupts the conversation when it comes back to our testosterone, though. Testosterone makes you a certain way as a man.
Oh,
apart from it being far more complex than that, it's not a demon hormone. It's actually an amazing hormone that protects you from a lot of things and gives you that strength to protect and be a certain, you know, recover from different things. It's critical to heart function and health in men, at least. You know, it's a pretty important hormone for a lot of things. It doesn't manifest as this horrible, angry, you know, alpha picture that was once painted of the ideal man or what masculinity was all defined by.
Yeah, no, that's a good point.
It's overly simplified, I think, the testosterone.
Good point. And last few, here we go. What is one of your weaknesses?
So, man, I'd have to dedicate a much larger website to that. Heaps of them, man. I'm still learning so much. I'm pretty active in addressing a lot of them, but I think
you certainly got a lot better at public speaking after being like, hey, I'll become a lecturer and speak for a living, and that certainly made that a lot better.
I try to, like, I'm probably a yes man more than I should be, and I do take on a bit too much. And I've done that a couple of times in life where I've spread myself way too thin and not given things due diligence and not given them the time that they deserved. And I've learned from some of those in some ways. In some ways, I'm still learning how to prioritize things. Well, I think that's something that I find difficult but enjoyable, working out how to best prioritize things in life and what's most important and how to structure things in a way that's dynamic and resilient to all the different changes that occur throughout life.
That's great.
At the moment, I'm adapting to full-time work. That's like, still, you know, it's only been a... Yeah, I mean, I've always sort of had full-time responsibilities and juggled lots of them, but to have one job and be just obsessed with the mastery of... At the moment, I've just spent a year training in microsurgery on very tiny hearts, and that's been a very steep learning curve. And I mean, I've worked in microsurgery for a while, but this has been a big... it's sort of almost obsessive in one area, and that's something that that's probably my biggest weakness, doing one thing and just being obsessed about that one thing and not worrying about all the other responsibilities I've got to take care of and manage.
Gotcha. Now, what is your top three favorite quotes? And who said them, if you can remember? But no, just the top three favorite quotes, if you have any. Or one.
Sorry, man.
It's okay, mate. That's all right. We can go on to the next one.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, no, that's okay. Now, here we go. So, last two questions. I'll start with this one because this one's a bit more fun. Say you have $1 million to spend in 1 week and you can't give it away. What do you do with it?
All right. Am I dead at the end of this week?
Well... You can be if you want, I suppose.
I don't know. I mean, if you've got, like, if I had to spend it, I think, so the confining it to probably the purpose of the question, like, what would I spend $1 million on if I had to spend it and wasn't investing and thinking about it, like, the future and that sort of thing?
Yeah, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Because otherwise I'd probably stick it all into bonds and different ways of investing and diversifying.
Yeah, okay. So the most irresponsible spending you can do.
It had to be spent in a week, and it wasn't going to set up a lifestyle. I mean, ideally, I'd like to, at some stage, and I don't actually want to do this now, but at some stage, if I had that sort of money, I'd be just lumped in my lap. I'd take some time to just write all the time and just go out somewhere nice and quiet and start a life that way. I'm not interested in this now, but maybe in the next 10, 15 years somewhere, I'd really like to just take the time off and focus on that sort of those creative pursuits just for a little while.
No, that's good. And that kind of ties in with the next one, I suppose, would be if you had 12 months to live from right now, what would those 12 months look like for you?
I don't know. I still have a lot of people in my life that I really care about. I'd probably work at how I need to. Yeah, I don't know, man. That's sort of, I'd be pretty logical about it, I think. I'd have to work out what I need to leave behind in different capacities, hand over. I probably would take a step back from these big sort of everything that I do is like a part of a 5-10 year journey. You know, all this research is nothing's done in a year. You know, so I don't know. I mean, I've heard stories and what people do actually do in those sort of situations, and a lot of those stories are people just keep doing things exactly as they would. You know, it doesn't change anything, even if like the goal of their current set of tasks is not going to be reached in a year. It's just about continuing that journey as if you're not going to end it. But I don't know. I think it'd be pretty different in that actual situation, but I think I'd prioritize just getting things sorted for people. But I'd probably also go into some terrible spin of despair at some stage as well. I don't think... who knows, man? That's a pretty heavy one. I don't think there's a way of accepting that very, very easily.
You know,
I don't admire people who've been put in that position. There's plenty of them, man. I feel terrible for them.
It's certainly, especially patients who the doctors say, hey, you have 3 months, or hey, you have 4 months, or hey, you have a month or a week. Like, imagine what it'd just be going through their mind. So,
yeah, it's reevaluating and reprioritizing the things that you want to leave behind and achieve. That's a pretty, I don't know, in some ways it'd probably be a bit bittersweet that it'd force your hand to do some things that you actually need to do and enjoy doing, and it would also cut away a lot of the things that you wish you still had the opportunity to do later on in life. But it'd change things so significantly, I think, that you'd be, I don't know, it'd be an interesting, terrifying, and it's a very unique interesting thing to go through, I suppose.
Absolutely. And on that note, mate, it's been a real pleasure, Dan, to have you on, mate, and for everything that you've shared about everything that you're doing, which is tremendously impressive, and the stories you have to tell, and all your experiences, and what you're doing into the future, mate. It's truly like, as humble as you are, as I know you are, it is truly inspiring what you're doing and the message that you're portraying, and hopefully everyone that's listened all the way through will have taken on board. And
it's a couple of hours we've been going for. Hey, look at that!
It's almost 2 hours. Yeah, absolutely, mate. Did you have any parting words or anything like that, Dan?
Like that, if anyone's made it this 2 hours of listening to me talk, thank you. Jeez, congratulations! You have persistence above most people.
It's probably a mate of mine, or it might be mum or someone like that. A big fan of mine. So, but
jeez, yeah, I'm not sure if my mum would really listen to it all the way through. Thanks, man. Thanks for the chat.
No, it's my.
I know that there's limitations to every story, and I'm not. I don't come off as preachy in any way, because I know it's everybody's very unique in their experiences, and it might not have any practical sense. But if any part of it makes sense to anybody, that's...
No, mate, I think it's really good. I certainly learned a lot, and just even with the little random interview questions that I have together, I just find it really interesting how people answer things differently. If I can compare the interviews that I've had so far, I can just like, wow, there's so many... People are obviously, everyone's just so different. Everyone has this different outlook, and I find that just so interesting. And you're a wealth of knowledge, mate. I'm looking forward to your book for sure.
Thanks, mate.
Yeah, no, that's great, Dan. We'll wind it up there. And everyone listening who's listened this far, thank you so very much for listening. And thank you to Dr. Dan Donner.